Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Week to Week, the Commonwealth Club's Political Roundtable program for Monday, January 27th, 2014. Thank you for coming out to join us here live, or listening to our podcast, or watching us on California Channel. I'm John Zipper, the Vice President of Media and Editorial at the Commonwealth Club, and your host for Week to Week. As always in our program, we'll go over the most important events of the past week or two, and of course, any opinions expressed by any of us up here or any of you in the audience are those only of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Commonwealth Club, its members, or supporters. Let me introduce our panelists today. I'm going to start on the far end of the... Carla Marinucci is a senior political reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. Dr. Larry Gersten, he's a political science professor at San Jose State University, the political analyst at NBC Bay Area, and the author most recently of Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California. He's on Twitter at L. Gersten. And next to me is Deborah J. Saunders, a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, where she also writes the token conservative blog for sfgate.com. Carla, you don't write a token liberal blog. Is there a reason for that?
No. The word token wouldn't apply.
Okay. Well, you can follow this token conservative on Twitter at Deborah J. Saunders. As always, use your question cards that are spread throughout the room to write down questions, send them in, we'll answer them. We'll try to work some of them in our discussion at the beginning of the program, but then we'll also devote the later part of the program specifically to your input. I wanted to start off with the big speech last week from Governor Jerry Brown. He gave the State of the State speech. I noticed today, actually, back in 61, I think it was, his father, Edmund Brown, spoke to the Commonwealth Club, in fact, and the topic of his speech was the state of California. So it's all cyclical here. But in Governor Brown's speech, Brown the Younger, he declared California to be a comeback state, and he named, of course, challenges going forward and what he hoped the legislature would work with him on. So let me start with you, Larry. What did the governor say in his speech, and what was significant about it?
I think what's significant about his speech is that he just... drawing this very straight path toward recovery, spending a bundle of money from the budget money coming in on paying back debt. The debt is, depending upon how you look at debt in California, it's anywhere between $25 billion and $800 billion. I think myself it's closer to $300. It's a lot of money, but that's for a lot of
billion,
things.
I'm sorry? Are you saying $300
billion? Yeah, billion. Yeah,
including liabilities. You're including future liabilities.
Pensions and what we owe the federal government, and there's so many different categories. It goes on and on. No, we're not out $300 billion a day. There's all these actuarial things as to how long people are expected to live, and so they put all that together, and what's happened is they haven't factored in enough money to last enough time.
Yeah.
And that's where we get to this whole question, by the way, of pension reform, which was interestingly quiet, not mentioned in that. Anyway, I think perhaps to me the most important thing was two things. What the governor didn't say. What happened to high-speed rail?
Yes, I noticed that.
Left at the station.
And he had one sentence. He mentioned high-speed rail in one sentence.
Yeah, and he said that quickly.
Yes, he did.
And he mumbled.
Yes.
And then the other thing I think was kind of interesting is that he talked about how we have to do a better job managing our water. Well, that screams to me water bond, which we will see in not the form that you see right now. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah. But, you know, I think what you're saying is what the governor didn't say. Look, this governor has given this address more than any other governor in California. Yeah. This is a record, right? So this is a guy who's done this so many times, he knows not to step on his own message. His message was fiscal responsibility. And, by the way, it was a campaign rollout because he said, there is no substitute for experience, by the way. I mean...
Neil.
He not only gave himself... He himself not only gave this fiscal responsibility message about a million times, he had his dog do it, too. He gave out playing cards with the dog's picture on it. Brilliant. I mean, and they became immediately collectibles in the Capitol. The guy knows better than anybody else out there how to put out something. And no distractions like high-speed rail, and, you know, we have bold new initiatives or any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Pension reform, as you mentioned. right down, you know, they say paddle to the right, paddle to the left with Jerry Brown. He took this kayak right down the center, and we were all left kind of, you know, and there he goes again.
He's so different from the way he was the first time around. I mean, he really is a different person. It's like he was cloned, sort of. Not completely. He's just a different person.
But I'm going to say one last thing. This just shows the experience, and, you know, he's so different from the first time around. Maybe, but he actually read it from paper at the podium. There's no teleprompter. How 1973 is that? I mean, you know.
Now, there was no Latin.
Yes,
it's a big disappointment for me. Everybody in the press corps knows that I can do the Latin references for you. But, you know, he is so amazing. The speech was under 18 minutes. You've got to love that. I mean, he's so succinct. And the other thing is, he's running for re-election, but he doesn't even have to announce it. That's how secure he is. There are no Democrats pawing at him. Mm-hmm. There are Republicans fighting over the chance to lose to him. He was just in his element, and he knew it. So.
Now, a central theme of his speech was the central government in Sacramento should only do what Sacramento has to do, that the, you know, local and counties should do more, yes, and what they can do. And can we talk about that a bit? I mean, was this a big change, or is this just,
you know,
forced by the fiscal?
He doesn't want any tax increases while he's running for governor. I mean, that's what he's not quite saying, is what he's trying to say. Republicans were pretty positive about the speech because they're hoping that he can. The message was, I'm not going to. He wasn't trying to wave a red flag in front of anybody. He wants to send the message that I can keep the Democrats in line and I can make sure that they're not going to do to me what they did to Gray Davis by prompting him to spend too much money and then have to pull back.
I mean, how crazy is it that it was the Republicans after the speech who said, you never mentioned poverty, Governor Brown. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how he flips everything. I mean, other commentators, Kathleen Decker, this in the LA Times the other day, and she's right on the money. He flips everything. This principle of subsidiarity that he talks about, you know, local government and so forth, he's pounded this a lot. But the fact is, you know, up there he was quoting the Bible, put away for 7 years of famine, blah, blah, blah.
Santa Ana.
You know, I mean, the guy knows how to get the message out, and you had the Republicans in the chamber. We were both there, sitting there going, God, I love it when he channels his inner Republican. And, you know, and the Democrats are biting on their pencils, trying not to, you know, criticize him.
To your local themes, there are two things I think are important. One is local education funding formula, where a bundle of money is about to go to English learners and poor students. And I don't believe that most people in the nice affluent suburbs understand the extent to which this Prop 30 money, or at least a large chunk of it, $2 billion plus, will be funneled away from their kids, and these are the ones who are paying for it, to the poor kids. Now, you know, they may, but I don't see it yet. I think we're going to see a negative reaction during the year as that begins to unfold. They're still working out the formula. The second thing is, the realignment program. And that, by the way, is attracted an awful lot of controversy. This isn't something that local governments craved, education funding. Please give us your prisoners.
Right. You know, realignment is where they're sending some lower, less dangerous prisoners down to the counties.
They tend to be older. They are allegedly nonviolent, people who are close to the end of their terms, this and that. But nonetheless, some areas, Los Angeles County and others, are just overflowing with these people. It leads to them to grant parole early. They don't have the people to monitor the parole things. And there's an awful lot of backlash developing in local governments. So I'm not so sure that while the message might be nice, I'm not so sure it's being received so well.
You know, and Deborah points out, I mean, where does this leave the Republicans as we go into 2014, particularly the ones that want to challenge him? Now you have two of them out there. We had Neel Kashkari, a former TARP manager. He has declared himself for governor, and he was up there also. Tim Donnelly, who's a real conservative Republican, and they're kind of left with this message of, well, California's not doing as well as it could, but he really has sort of pulled the rug out of the Republicans, and it's the Democrats who are really left saying, hey, we've got supermajorities. What are we getting for it up here? They're the ones who seem more concerned.
Or maybe they realize that he's saving them from themselves.
Yeah. Or maybe they're realizing until they get through this election, and if they get the absolute two-third majority again, boom. And that's what I think you'll see.
Well, I think there's more to what Deborah said, which is that knowing that he is going to put the stop on certain things allows them to vote for something that may get them votes back for themselves back home, but then they're not forced to deal with the consequences of the overspending that that might have brought about.
Yeah. I mean, this is sort of the brilliance of the whole thing in the sense that he's always been seen as the you know, adult in the room up there. But you're talking about some of the things that are very close to the Democrats' hearts, big cuts in social programs, mental health programs, talking to Daryl Steinberg up there after the speech. I mean, they want some of these back, and they're going to have to now figure out how to do this. But the governor's already saying on things like universal preschool, prudence is the order of the day. And I don't think we've heard a politician use the word prudence up there in a long time. And he's just going to keep pounding it.
Okay. Well, let's move from the state of the state to what we're going to hear tomorrow night, which is the State of the Union when President Obama gives his address to Congress. Let's start with Carla. I mean, what do you think we're going to be hearing? Or what do you know? You said you were talking with the White House today.
Yeah, in fact, the White House had sort of a preview call just a little bit ago on this speech, and they wouldn't come out with any specifics on initiatives he's going to propose. They kept using the word optimism, you know, economic recovery. And look, the president is going to talk about how I think, yes, a lot of progress has been made. He is going to try to emphasize the progress that has been made despite some very difficult political machinations up there in Congress and how he's going to maybe use his own executive power to push some things forward. They talked about job retraining. They talked about education, getting middle-class Americans more a piece of the economic recovery. And you're going to be seeing things like that. I heard reporters asking questions about, well, is he going to mention climate change? Is he going to mention the drought? Well, we're not sure about that. But the major themes, I think, are going to be what they've done so far and now how the president moves on from here and uses his own power in addition to working with Congress, I think, on issues like immigration reform.
Larry, how is that going to go over, the president asserting his own power on these things?
Well, I think we're in interesting territory here, and you really, it starts with Roosevelt, if you want to go all the way back, but in recent presidencies, more and more, we've seen the president use that pen to issue a series of executive orders, and executive orders are allowed as a way of implementing existing legislation. You just can't write an executive order about anything. But if you could attach it to some legislation that's been passed, not even immediately, passed legislation, then you've got some constitutional grounds. But what I find interesting is that he's resorting to this, I think, with a lot of frustration. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not getting anything from these guys. And you begin to tread on some very touchy ground here. People like Rand Paul saying, and I think he's got an audience. I know that's shocking here, but listen, you know, there are three branches of government, not just one, and the president needs to understand that the reason why it's so hard to get legislation is because we have basically divided government. Well, the more you ignore that, the more you are raising the bar in a sense of getting people, I think, somewhat upset with you, not just the other side, constitutional whiz kids and whatnot. So I think he's got to be careful.
Deborah?
I just remember the Bush years when everybody was yelling about the executive orders that he was signing.
And the signing statements.
The signing statements, and they were just, they felt that he was that he was overusing his executive power. And I watched this president, I think the same thing. I mean, we look at Obamacare. He keeps talking about Republicans trying to undermine it. How many things has he taken back? The employer mandate. There are so many things that he's just, by the sign of a pen, overridden what Congress wants. And he doesn't, in my mind, he doesn't try to work across the aisle that much. I think the interesting thing to watch for will be what he has to say on immigration. The Republicans are supposed to roll out this plan, and apparently what it's going to have in it is it's going to be piecemeal bills, which is a smart way to go. You know, there'll be something for farm workers, H-1B visas, DREAM Act kind of stuff. And then instead of a path to citizenship, it looks as though there's going to be basically a path to legalization for families that have ties to the community. And that's a very passable package, mm-hmm. Probably. Not 100%, but a very passable package. Now, for a long time, the president was saying, no compromise on this. It's got to be what I want. But Dan Pfeiffer was on with Chris Wallace yesterday, and he was signaling that maybe they would cut a deal. That's what I want to see what the rhetoric will be tomorrow night on that. That's what I'm going to be watching for.
Yeah, I think it depends on how many pieces are in that deal. Okay? I mean, if it's just for H-1B and farm workers, forget it. It's not going to go. Well, but if there is somewhere that path, and then the number of years, whatever they might be, then you got the basis of it. But I do want to take issue on one thing. It's one thing to talk about the executive orders. Signing statements, nobody used signing statements like George W. Bush. You can go as far back as you want. He did more signing statements than all the other guys combined. Obama promised he would never do it. He's done about a half a dozen. But George W. Bush, that's where you take a law and you turn it inside out.
Well, how do you say Republicans shouldn't mess with Obamacare because it's the law of the land, passed by Congress, signed by the president, upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, and then keep rewriting your own that law? How do you do that?
Because a lot of laws, that one included, have enough wiggle room for the executive on his own to do certain things. That's built into the legislation. You know legislation. It sets a broad framework. And any executive can almost, depending upon the legislation, unless it's extremely narrow, can tweak it. You know, people just don't like that. You don't like that he's squeaking.
Well,
I get it. I get that. But believe me, the courts would be stopping it in no time if they could.
I know we're going to be talking about marijuana a little bit later, I think.
Yep.
And I was talking to somebody from one of the pro-legalization groups saying to him, well, I saw, you know, the president's comments on marijuana. And he was saying to me that the president could sign an executive order making marijuana not a Schedule I drug under the Controlled Substances Act. I'm like, wait a minute. That was a measure passed by Congress. Now, I don't think it should be a Schedule I drug, but aren't you supposed to work with Congress? If people want to have a king president, they can have that, but their party's not always going to be in power.
That's right.
But I think, I mean, listen, even when he was here in San Francisco this last time, I covered both of those events. At both events, he got hecklers in the audience saying, you know, use your executive power.
Yeah.
And he said to them, he's getting a lot of pressure from the left. Look, I'm not a king. I can't do that. I'd like to, there's lots of things I'd like to do, but there is this.
And yet he used that excuse for saying, I have to uphold immigration law, and then later on he decided that he was going to basically do a quasi-Dream Act on his own. So there are times that he says that, but he doesn't necessarily follow through. But I'm not bitter.
Well, let's talk about a drier topic, and that is the drought. Thank you. The rest of the country, of course, is laboring under like a foot of snow or something, but here in California we have a drought emergency. The governor has called it the worst in 100 years. We touched a bit of this, touched on this a bit during the State of the State topic, but I mean, what role do you think the drought will play in the state elections? What do you think the state can and will do, or at least that will be tried?
Oh, I think we're already seeing the role in state elections when you have the House Speaker come out to the Central Valley, as he did last week, with three Republicans, stand there with three Republicans who are somewhat endangered, and talk about let's deliver water from the Delta to the farmers there, which had George Miller like up in arms saying, look, I mean, when you talk about California agriculture, that's 80% of the water usage in this state and 3% of the economy. And there are other people that rely on that water, too. The Republicans are moving forward with this. Carolyn Lockhead, our Washington bureau chief, just wrote a story on this a few minutes ago
about how they're
moving forward with legislation on that issue of the water in the Delta. And I think that's going to have a lot of Democrats here up in arms. Water wars, you know, you're talking about this is the driest year in recorded history, and some of the stories suggest this could be, some of these droughts in California have gone on for 200 years. This could be a long-term thing that we're going to have to get used to, and everybody better get ready for it. But now we're already seeing a tug of war, and Boehner's move, I thought, was sort of a throwdown on that this week.
Yeah, but I just for the very reasons you said, the Northern Californians and liberals and others being an uproar, I don't see the national government doing much on that except for allowing farmers to drill more wells on federal land and things like that, which they've done in the past. They did that 35 years ago. I think the big question will be whether there'll be a water bond. Mm-hmm. And there's been one twice that was pulled back at the last minute, an $11.1 billion mm-hmm. bond. It is already on the November ballot right now. I don't think it'll be there in its present form. I think because there've been two big issues with it. One, of course, well, three. One, the environmentalists over dams, and secondly, their concerns about the Delta, and third, the fact that private owners, managers, would make a whole bunch of money from the way that the bond is set up, and that's piqued a lot of people. So I think you'll see something smaller, but I think they use water storage. It's not a dam. It's water storage. Doesn't that sound better?
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like we don't have smog here. We have haze. Okay? They have smog in Los Angeles. But I think you'll see it. And I think it'll be probably in the neighborhood of about $6 billion. And it will probably create a dam or two and touch on management and probably stay away from the peripheral canal stuff. Just too touchy.
Will this become a big political issue in the state elections, do you think?
Or yeah, it will.
Because
yeah.
of the cost.
But like Carla said, I mean, you've got Jerry Brown running against Jerry Brown. I mean, who, you know, Neil Kashkari is the candidate of 2018. You know, this is just a fashion show for him. You know, and yeah, Brown will get... you know, how can he not unless he gets ill?
He has mentioned these water tunnels, very expensive projects. He just glossed over that at the State of the State address also, so we might be hearing more about that. But, I mean, this is setting up some very divisive interests here between Big Ag and some of the other, you know, the salmon, for instance, the fisheries. These are worth a lot of jobs, too, in California. So you're looking at some very tough times ahead if this continues.
And don't forget, the votes are in Southern California. You know, the votes
as are
in Southern
both
California.
Legislative leaders. So.
For the first time in memory.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a good timing is everything when it comes to this kind of election. So you want people to get to the point where they say, "Oh my God, I got to cut back water. I can't wash my car. I can't water the lawn." You begin to feel this personally, and then the appeal for the bond vote. The timing is all of it, and I think you'll see it.
Okay. Well, let's go into more of the election issue, the issues, the candidates. We've a number of times here mentioned Mr. Kashkari. Carla, you've done some work on this. Sorry. Tell us what makes him such
well,
a...
Well, he's a very interesting. He's 40 years old, an Indian American, and a very sharp guy who was really a Wall Street whiz kid in management of this TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program. But of course, one of the things we always do when we have a gubernatorial candidate is look at their voting record. And we found that in more than half the elections in which he was eligible, he did not vote, including some big ones, like the last Republican primary. The Schwarzenegger ballot, where he had many initiatives. And you've got to wonder, these people are running for governor. But I have to say that... He's trying to sort of present a profile of a different kind of Republican, and I think that could be interesting. One who's pro-choice, pro-gay marriage. He's a lot on social media. I think he's banking on those 20% of Californians who are independent voters and on a lot of young voters and millennial voters, and hoping to make that contrast with Jerry Brown, with age and experience versus youth and energy, and he certainly has that.
You know, I have to say, I saw Neil Kashkari make his announcement last week, and I was sort of underwhelmed. There has been a group of people who have been pushing him, saying he's sort of like the new hope for the Republican Party. He's Indian American. He's libertarian on social issues. He can draw people to the party and really change things. And all I can think is it's going to lose to Jerry Brown. And so how is that going to really make a difference? And if he actually does threaten Jerry Brown, they're going to crucify him. They're going to turn him into Meg Whitman. The thing is, the argument that he has is that he really ran TARP well and it saved the taxpayers money. But everybody hates TARP. it's true. From everything I understand about this, it's true. But it's just the fact that you have to start off saying, yeah, I'm the guy who ran TARP, but I really did a great job. I just don't see how that gets through to people. Now, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, I don't want to make up my mind too quickly. So then there's this guy, Tim Donnelly. He's an assemblyman, former Minuteman, very conservative. He's the guy who is best well-known because when he tried to get through TSA, he had his gun with him. He forgot that he had his gun when he tried to get on the plane.
A loaded gun.
A loaded gun. Now, by the way, I once found myself in Rome at the airport and realized that I'd taken pepper spray with me and hadn't been caught, so I am in no position to point fingers on that. No position to point fingers on that. The thing is, he's a happy warrior. Neil Kashkari's announcement, he never mentioned Jerry Brown. Come on.
He also didn't mention he voted for Obama in 2008.
Yeah, he voted for Obama. That's another thing.
A lot of
right?
Republicans said so he doesn't go over.
So can bring
well.
Obama voters over to the Republican yeah. Party. Anyway, the idea, I mean, this is, I have a pet peeve about the Chronicle. The way that we overly write about Republicans, because I like to remind people, did you know that there are Democrats in this state? We're always talking about what are the Republicans going to do when, you know, this is sort of, it's sort of like cheerleaders making fun of wallflowers, if you ask me. And this is a case where, so you're going to see Republicans fighting. Now, I think that Jerry Brown could be vulnerable. Larry mentions realignment. This is something where there may well be some people who are let out of, who are not put into prison because of realignment, who do some very horrible things. The Bay Bridge, when we find out, there were hearings last week where we found out some really ugly things about the construction of the Bay Bridge. And it's a reason to not vote for high-speed rail. And these are things with which somebody could criticize the governor. And I think it would resonate with voters, but Neil Kashkari forgot to do it.
I have a whole different take here. This election, it's already January, okay? Next January, mm-hmm. Governor Brown is reelected, okay? That's that. This is just a bunch of fluff. This is the rollout for 2018. That's what this is. And, you know, everybody expects him to lose, which makes it even better because, you know, the bar is so low. You know, can you say his name? He's already doing well. Okay? I mean, and so...
But by the way, Tim Donnelly can say his name, Cash and Carry.
There you go. Unfortunately, that won't resonate much more than past Mrs. Donnelly. So, you know, I mean, he is a bright guy. He's articulate. He can put away this whole notion about not voting, which we've talked about.
Why doesn't he run for treasurer? Why doesn't he run for controller?
Because... We haven't talked.
Because he's too important?
Because he thinks he's an executive in the highest sense of the term. But I mean, the point I'm trying to make is he could deal with this not voting thing by saying, I never viewed myself 20 years ago, mm-hmm. 10 years ago, as a political activist, as an elected official. But I get it now. I see what it has to be. Okay, well, time, memory's short. I see it now. I see my role. I've worked well with business. I've worked well in government. You know, this is a new era. I'm your guy, and he's got 4 years to work this out. You will see this guy running in 2018, and I think he'll make a splash. I'm not going to tell you he's going to get elected, but I think he's going to be a splash. He's not about to go away.
You mean just like Bill Simon?
But he's so much just more like than Meg Bill Whitman. Simon.
But however, this one's going to be run under the top two primary.
Right. Maybe you're right. Maybe I'm wrong.
This one's going to be run under the top two primary for the first time. All of the statewide offices are going to be under the top two primary, which really is a game changer in a lot of cases, and in the congressional races as well. So it isn't, you know, under the old system, yeah, Tim Donnelly might have been just a lock to be the nominee for the Republican Party. This time around, it's whoever comes in number two. And so that's why he's throwing the dice on this. I think you're right on that, Larry. And it's going to be interesting to see if those, you know, younger voters, those conservatarians,
millennials,
the libertarians come out and decide that's where they want to throw it, and that means it could be interesting going in.
He doesn't have to win. All he has to do, he'll come in second.
All he has to do is
get somewhere in the... But he'll
That's
lose with...
All he has to do is lose.
With dignity.
Well, Larry, that was what Ronald Reagan did in 76. But he spent that whole decade fighting for the soul of the Republican Party from his view and changing it toward his view. is Kashkari the kind of person who
you're absolutely right. That's the big difference. Kashkari has never been in the Republican. He's never gone to any of these events. I mean, just last week, I think he went to the assembly caucus up there, and somebody tweeted that he was the only guy in the room who voted for Obama. You know, I mean, he's like, he doesn't know these people. He's introducing to himself to them now. So, yeah, maybe that's part of a long process and a long strategic plan here that we're seeing. And it'll be interesting to watch. And it'll be interesting to watch if Jerry Brown debates him. Because Deborah and I have argued about this. She thinks Jerry Brown will maybe try and get away with not debating him.
And by the way, we don't know that he's going to.
Yeah.
I mean, he could be the channel. He could be the, I assume, second top vote getter.
Yeah.
But he may not be.
He may not
be.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, what are some of the other elections that we'll be seeing around here, whether it's congressional races or?
The top two primary we talked about. I mean, this is where I think it's getting interesting in California, because this race in Silicon Valley with Ro Khanna and Mike Honda, which I know we've talked about, is getting more and more fascinating. I mean, the money is, this could be one of the most expensive congressional races in the country. We're already seeing Ro Khanna, who's amassed 3-1 cash over Mike Honda, a seven-term Democrat who has every Democrat, including Barack Obama, behind him. Silicon Valley has weighed in on this big time. And we had redistricting, so a lot of the district has changed. The old district that Mike Honda had isn't the same. But, you know, as you pointed out, Larry, in many of our stories, Mike Honda has a long elected history in that district in San Jose. It is not going to be easy to unseat him, and this is going to be a real test of the top two primary when you have a young Indian American. Again, this is the only majority Asian congressional district in the lower 48. And a huge Indian American population, and so you see him versus Honda, who's also an icon in the Asian community. You have age, you know, Honda 72, Akana's 37. You have the age difference, and you have the labor versus tech. And Akana is very big in the Silicon Valley community.
Yeah, in San Francisco, I have no idea about this labor versus tech thing. Are some people arguing about that?
The Indian American population, and let's remember that no group is a monolithic. We tend to dump people.
Yes,
you know, you're that group. Okay, I'll march. We know that's not true, but the Indian American population, Indo-American, is about 12%. Okay? But let's remember that a number of these minority populations in this district, as with others, are young. Many are not citizens. We want to separate the population, that group, from the voters. And you're going to see a voting population, as in the rest of the state, that it's much more tilted toward whites. And those whites are probably likely are going to be older, and they're going to identify with somebody like Honda. So what Khanna has to do is grab a much larger percentage of those minorities than people think right now. And I'm not saying he can't do it. Money plays a big role, but ask Meg Whitman, ask others, money plays a limited role. It is, and I've categorized it, I've had both sides get mad at me from this, it is largely tech versus labor. You know, oh no, I have other people besides it. Oh no, I have other. Baloney. It's largely tech versus labor. And that culture clash, I'm not so sure will be played out the way people think it might, because of all these other variables, once you tease out who's in that district.
What's interesting, though, I think Akana has a lot of the same people who ran Obama's campaign running his, and he's got, you know, incredible stuff going on the social media side. Now, Honda, as you said, has long roots going back there. It is going to be, I think, one of these races where you're going to see the tipping point. Is tech going to be able to show its muscle? And Indian American community, too, I think. I mean, this is a population that 80% of them arrived here since the mid-80s. I mean, and they have four times the educational level of almost any other ethnic group in the country, and I think it's twice the income level. I mean, they have really succeeded in this country, and speaking to some of the leaders of that community, they say, we don't feel like we've been gotten representation in Congress for some of the huge gains that they've made. There's only one member of Congress, Ami Bera, who's being challenged right now. He's going to have a race on his hands, too. So I think it's going to be interesting to watch. This is California's always ahead of the wave on these demographic stories, and I think this is why the whole country's watching that race.
Deborah, what are you watching this year?
One of the things that's upsetting to me is that as I look at the statewide races, that there are a number of offices for which there's no Republican running. I mean, to me, Kamala Harris would be somebody who would be really easy for the Republicans to pick off. There's no candidate who has come forward. Same for treasurer, controller. It's important to have somebody in place just in case somebody dies. I mean, you want to... That's how you think in politics. So you just want to have somebody who's there just in case, some bizarre thing happens that changes everything. I think you're going to see a change. And Carla has talked a little bit about this. There may be a change in the elections coming up where you have moderate Democrat versus far-left Democrat. You may see some more challenges like that. I mean, we saw that with Eric Swalwell versus Pete Stark. And I think when I look at Mike Honda and versus Ro Khanna, I think people are getting a little antsy about people, about members who have been in their seats too long and act as if they own them. And I think that's part of the reason why George Miller got out, although it was probably more about pure boredom about being in the party that doesn't have leadership. So.
The reason... we don't see Republicans in these statewide offices, I'm sorry to say, is because there's virtually no Republican Party.
I mean, agree. The bench is empty.
Yeah, this is where a guy like Kashkari, if he's true to what I think, can make long-term difference. Republicans have got to wake up. Wake up. We can't all be over 80 and white. Until that day happens, until that day happens, this party in this state particularly is just going to just die on the vine. I just shake them every time I can be with one who's an activist. You guys have got to open this thing up. And I think a guy like Kashkari down the road has that possibility. Not just him, but people like him.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about, as you gave a little hint before, marijuana. We've discussed this, the increasing support in this country for ending the drug war a number of times on this program. I wanted to bring it up today because I'm curious about whether President Obama has finally shifted significantly or if that was just a feint. One of the things the president has done recently was he pardoned 8 drug offenders. One of the people who was pardoned was Clarence Aaron, whose case Deborah has championed for more than a decade. So, Deborah, take a victory lap and explain what about this case was it that got you so interested in it?
Well, I started writing about... federal offenders serving really long sentences for low-level drug crimes when Bill Clinton was president. And I started writing about Clarence Aaron when George Bush was president because I was just shocked to find out that this guy was a 23-year-old college student, and he broke the law and he deserved to go to prison. He hooked up 2 drug dealers for 2 very big crack cocaine deals, and because of the way the law works for the amounts... and for the fact that you can be charged for drugs that weren't even traded, that you had nothing to do with, and the fact that the kingpins in this deal knew enough to plead guilty and testify against Clarence Aaron, and he foolishly pleaded not guilty and lied on the stand, and everything worked against him, he was sentenced to life without parole for a first-time nonviolent drug conviction. And to me, that's just astonishing. He's really behaved himself in prison, had a really good record there. They moved him from maximum security to medium. There were a lot of people who were pushing for him to get out. According to the ACLU, there are 2,000 inmates in federal prison for nonviolent drug offenses doing life without parole. That's just astonishing to me. And if somebody who has been a critic of the drug war... and believes in government doing fewer things well it's just been appalling. And I thought when I pushed for George Bush to commute Clarence's sentence, and he actually asked the pardon attorney to go take a look at it. And unfortunately, the pardon attorney he had didn't tell him that the U.S. attorney in the case and the judge in the case supported a commutation, and hence it was turned down. Now, I don't understand quite why President Obama has kept the same pardon attorney in office. And he's been very stingy with pardons. In fact, George W. Bush commuted more sentences than Barack Obama to date. And there was only one commutation in Barack Obama's first term. Now there are nine with these eight people who were let out. What's really amazing is, when I've talked about this before, I've had people approach me and say, well, Barack Obama can't do commutations because the Republicans will crucify him. Did anybody hear anyone criticize these commutations?
No one.
I mean, yeah. I looked for this. Nobody criticized this. As a matter of fact, there's a very strong conservative contingent, a group called Right on Crime, that has been pushing for changes in the war on drugs and in limiting these sentences. I think you may begin to see a change from the president on this. He's signaling a change. When he says to the New Yorker that he doesn't think that marijuana is more dangerous than alcohol, you really have to wonder why. It's a Schedule I drug. Eric Holder last week said that the administration was no longer going to prevent banks from they're working out regulations so that banks can lend money to medical marijuana dispensaries and in businesses in Colorado and Washington. But they're so slow. They have been dragging their feet. Now, maybe we'll see. The thing that we really learned from same-sex marriage, and I think that we're seeing with marijuana, is that when public opinion changes, it changes like this. I mean, it's not...
Yeah.
I always thought of it as something that's really slow, but it changes so quickly. And that's what happened with Prohibition. 2 years before Prohibition ended in this country, people were saying that it could not be done. And I think you're going to see that happen with marijuana in this country. And the question is, how late... there's no question that Barack Obama will jump onto the wave. Mm-hmm. The only question is when.
John, I just want to say that on the case of Clarence Aaron really quickly, I just have to give total props to my colleague here. Because you get into this business to try and change things. And she persistently wrote about this case for years, the only one out there who did not forget this guy who was sentenced at age 23 to life without parole for a nonviolent offense. So I say total props to you for doing that. I mean, and I think, and please... When we found out that, about that commutation, she burst into tears in the op-ed office, and I have to say, that's the kind of thing that matters in this business. But on marijuana, when you're talking about, I got to get to that, the changes, the overnight changes, I just read this morning that the Denver County Fair is going to have joint rolling contests and blue ribbon pot jam judging. Now, come on. You know California's going to want to get in on this. I'm sorry. It's a matter of, like, not very much time.
Maybe that's why tomorrow the president is speaking in a joint session before Congress. Now I get it.
Probably a good time to move on to our next topic. And that is the politics of income inequality. Of course, President Obama has said this is going to be a focus of the rest of his time in office. Pope Francis has made it the centerpiece of his papacy. We're also seeing now, and I think it's a new trend or an uptick in this, Republican leaders, Marco Rubio, the senator, Representative Paul Ryan, trying to apply conservative approaches to income inequality, but actually addressing it as opposed to kind of the shouting matches we've had on talk show TV for a while. Deborah, do you see anything really happening here, or is this just the topic of the week that everyone's playing to?
Well, as you know, Ron Unz, a Republican, is pushing this measure to increase the minimum wage, and there are some Republicans who have nodded toward it. And I have to say, I mean, I could be for it, except I think it depresses employment. I think it makes it hard. I think it makes it harder for young people to get jobs, and I think that they should tie the minimum wage so that it goes up with inflation. But I'm not really sure that that would be a great thing for the economy. I think Republicans are trying to come up with a message. Here's the thing: the president keeps talking about income inequality, but the economy doesn't get any better. And the idea that if you tax a certain amount of people more money, that it's going to make the economy get better, just doesn't seem to be working. We've seen a lot of businesses that aren't hiring. They're uncertain about the future, and I just don't see that it works. Tom Perkins, of course, handled that in not the most tactful way.
Explain who he is.
The venture capitalist wrote a letter to the Wall Street Journal over the weekend. It was printed, and he basically compared 1%, the 99% movement and people who are against the 1% with Nazis, and said that he said everybody thought that Kristallnacht couldn't happen. Oops, that's me. Everybody thought that Kristallnacht. Is this still working? Because I dropped it?
Yeah.
Okay. Everybody thought that Kristallnacht couldn't happen in 1930. Are we in the same position here because people are demonizing the rich the way the Nazis demonized Jews?
I mean, is he insane?
It's totally,
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. No, you do not compare anybody to Nazis unless they're Nazis.
Yeah. You know who are the Nazis? The Nazis. You know who's not like the Nazis? Everybody else.
That's right. So Stalin... You know, the Italian fascists, maybe.
Yeah, there are a lot of bad people out there, but...
collaborators you can maybe tie with the Nazis. That's it. So anyway, this is the sort of rhetoric that we have. And it's too bad, because I think he could have made some really great policy points about the idea that by targeting the rich as the solution to the country's economics, suggesting that raising taxes is going to make everything better is not necessarily a smart idea. Unfortunately, he decided to complain about... He made that a ridiculous analogy.
Come on. I mean, the guy is the fifth husband of Danielle Steele, or was. Yeah.
And he defended her in the letter,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, she's had problems because of her hedge, you know. I mean, really, this guy should just man up. I was saying to Deborah on the way here... Look, there are countries that really target the rich. I mean, try living in, like, Colombia or places where, you know, people are, like, kidnapped. Their kids are kidnapped, you know, when they make over $40,000 a year, right? I mean, here, I don't think Tom Perkins has a whole lot to complain about. And this kind of, you know, this Nazi reference, it was totally offensive and insane.
I think that the Perkins thing really gets us off the big issue.
Yeah.
I'm now working on a book on re-engaging American citizenship, and so the question I ask is, why are people not involved? Why do they not care? And bit by bit, as I've gone through this little odyssey, I love doing this sometimes. Sometimes I shoot myself. You know, I've discovered things that are just heartbreaking to me. And, you know, we paper over these things. I won't paper over it. There is a chasm here between the haves and the have-nots, and it is not maintained. It has actually grown deeper and deeper and deeper. Come up with any time, post-recession even, post-recovery even, the chasm has grown. And those who have benefited, the 1%, the 5%, tell me wherever you want to cut it off. I can give you 1, 5, or 10, have gathered by far so much of the money in this era. And so you can come up with various defenses, but the data are the data, and you just cannot deny it. And I believe this is going to be the focal point for 2016. I don't think Obama's going to get anything done now because Congress is what it is. And I think as the voter cohort changes, as more and more people at the bottom start having the opportunity to get involved, you guys watch out. You're going to see some fundamental changes down the road. And when you talk about taxes and income, this is the lowest of any industrialized country in terms of our tax rates, even for the wealthy. So we have a lot to learn, and I think it's going to hit a lot of us in ways that we can't even imagine right now.
So how does taxing, and I'm not one of them, so how does taxing rich people make the economy better?
Well, for one thing, you start providing enough income to those at the bottom so that they can participate in the economy. That's one of the arguments, Deborah, about this whole extension of the... Hold on. This whole extension of unemployment benefits, you know, they've already figured out that it's going to cost 200,000 jobs just by not providing money for these people at the bottom to live. I mean, these things get far more complicated. We tend to make it... Well, they're not working hard. That's why. No, it's not because of that.
But how does taxing rich people more help
you
the economy?
It's called redistribution. Uh-huh. That's what it's called. It's called redistribution, and you take that money and you put it in places where they don't have it, and that spreads it out in the economy, and more people are employed, and more people are off the bottom. And you know who doesn't like it? Two groups. Those at the top. I can't blame them. And those who are looking to get to the top. And in the United States, most of us want to get to the top. So we don't want to see that kind of thing happen. So but it's going to happen.
Yeah, well, the problem is that we've come to this position where we pinpoint this small group of people and want and talk as if we can do all the things that you want to do with government. I wouldn't do as many, I assure you, bet on their backs, and it just doesn't work that way. If you want to have a tax hike, go down and hit more people with it. And do less of one than deciding that you're going to have these huge hikes on a small number of people. You don't get that much money for it. It doesn't do the changes. What this basically has done is made it so that a lot of people like Tom Perkins don't feel like investing in certain things, don't want to hire people. Obamacare has definitely contributed to that. They're going to start cutting off benefits because it doesn't work. We've decided that we're going to have this vast welfare culture carried by a few people. And guess what? The whole time we've been doing that, this chasm has grown.
Well, there are a whole bunch of assumptions here.
Yeah.
Time doesn't allow us to get into all of them. But it's not just about taxing the very wealthy. How about the $2 trillion? That's trillion. How about the $2 trillion parked offshore? How about the corporations that pay zero income tax? Zero. Okay? Well, that's the American way. Good for them.
No,
I don't think so. So we're talking about a lot more than just the wealthy Warren Buffetts out there. We're talking about creating tax reform that in some way...
But the president isn't talking about tax reform. There are a lot of Republicans and Democrats who could get together on tax reform, something that's more broad-based and less punitive. I mean, that's, believe me, I'm for that.
Something that's going to touch everybody here on this issue is there are going to be now ballot measures that deal with some of these issues. One of them talking about limiting the pay of hospital executives, where we've seen some of them make a couple of $1 million at nonprofit hospitals. Another one is a tax on the oil companies. That's promoted by Tom Steyer, who's pretty rich himself.
And who will probably spend $40 or $50 million
to run for governor at some point, too. And the other one is also promoted by a very wealthy Republican, raising the minimum wage to $12 an hour. So we're starting to see some of these come before the voters. And that's where sort of it's all going to hit the road on this issue. I mean, you know, it's one thing to talk about the ultra-rich, but then what we're seeing in San Francisco is some of these Google bus, you know, protests. Not all these folks are rich. I mean, and they're, you know, it's getting their cars off the road. There's a lot of good things about those buses and a lot of envy here. But when Tom Perkins talks about the envy of the successful 1%, like the rest of the 99 are a bunch of slackers, I mean, that's the kind of divisive stuff.
We will definitely be seeing this issue continue for a while. Why don't we try to run through a few questions? I know, Deborah, you have to leave a little bit early, so feel free to head out. One thing we didn't talk about was what is Gavin Newsom's future, our former mayor here and current lieutenant governor.
We saw him at the State of the State address, and Willie Brown just threw out a bombshell to me the other day by saying that Newsom consciously stole the thunder from Jerry Brown, that it was a contrast between bold youth and, you know, cautious, you know, age. And it's true that Gavin Newsom did get a lot of attention talking about how we have to be a pro-business environment. I thought it was his campaign rollout for whenever and whatever. We have to be a pro-business environment. He does give a great speech. So, I mean, everybody watched it, and now everybody's wondering, was he really trying to upstage Jerry Brown at that at that little event?
Of course, he was introduced as the former mayor of Sacramento.
That is true.
That's how Daryl Steinberg introduced
a little bump in the road.
Well, and in kind, the governor did do a call out to Deborah's best friend, Sutter Brown, but not to the lieutenant governor.
Yeah, so.
Maybe for you, Larry, is repeal of Proposition 13 still serious? Are we going to see that?
No. Next. I think this gets to after the 2014 election, what I was alluding to earlier. Mm-hmm. I think that's when you're going to see the Democrats now feeling in pretty good shape, knowing that 2016 is a big turnout election. That's when they're going to flex their muscles. They've had to just operate with, like, tape over their mouth. thanks to Jerry Brown and Daryl Steinberg. Mm-hmm. But I think once this 2014 election gets over, if they've got the two-thirds majority in both houses, I think they're going to try to pick away at 13, not overturn it, but pick away, make some sort of modest changes. Yeah, I think you can expect that.
Okay.
Either you have any sense of if the Warriors will be on the will be an issue on the ballot?
That's
I think
issue.
I think this one is another one of those income inequality issues in a way. When you had the Warriors originally proposing high-end condos, right. high-end hotels, and you had Art Agnos out there. I followed him around several nights with just his little whiteboard out there talking to community groups all over the place. And pretty much he has, I think he's in some ways succeeded where this proposal has changed. It's been toned down. They're talking about maybe getting rid of those condos altogether. We saw how this went with the 8th Washington Project, where a lot of people said, we don't need that kind of wealthy, you know, on our front, you know, Embarcadero. So I think you're going to see it before the voters because I think these community groups have raised enough issues and it goes right to that income inequality story.
This question actually leads to something we could probably talk about for quite a while, but I'll just put it out here for hopefully some short responses. And that is, how has Governor Brown's wife, Ann, played a role in his political evolution and his success?
I think she's huge. I think she is... A lot of people up there call her the co-governor. I mean, you know, she's by every account, and if you've ever talked to her, she's just a very intelligent. She's sharp. She's the best political advisor, and she's really changed the way he interacts with people, and I think that is the biggest single thing she's done. I mean, if you look at, on their Twitter account even this week, they've got selfie photos of them, you know. I mean,
yeah, like, the restaurant.
Yeah, the restaurant. At original, was it Original Joe's?
Yeah, Westlake.
He never did this stuff before. She's very aware, and I think those Sutter Brown cards were, that was Ann Gus all over the place.
She's brought his feet right down to the ground. I mean, you know, talk about a difference in a person's life.
Absolutely.
And this is just a minor point, but I don't see him every day. I see him once every 3 or 4 years someplace, but every time I do, since he's been married to her, and of course she's in tow.
Yeah.
And the first thing is say, hi, you know my wife, Ann? I mean, I you know, he's just so taken by her, and I think in lots of ways benefited from her, like a real nice marriage.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, then last question before we head into our news quiz and then out there for our social. Someone asked about the role of small business, calling it's to the economy like the wetlands are to the ecology. So, is small business a target of Brown in any of his plans this year? Are there champions of small business? Or when we talk about labor versus tech, we usually kind of talk about two giant groups and not the folks who are running the shop down.
Small business, this is where there's an opening against Jerry Brown. This is where Neil Kashkari and Tim Donnelly are going to go. And Republicans are constantly pounding this. Because why? Because a lot of Latinos, ethnic voters, that's their entry into the American economy. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who are suffering a lot. And people have brought up the Affordable Care Act and how that's affected them.
It's a huge portion of the economy. Mm-hmm. We overlook this. And, you know, it's so interesting about the Affordable Care Act because that act, as I see it, goes way out of its way to provide subsidies for small businesses. And they don't even know it. You know, I talked to a guy who works on cars. And he's got 8 or 10 people there. And I said, have you looked in it? No, it's not going to be good. It's not going to be good because the Obama and healthcare, they're against business. Well, that Affordable Care Act goes out of its way to provide subsidies for all kinds of groups, including small businesses.
Okay. Well, very good. I'm going to thank you. There are some questions, great questions here I couldn't get to. Thank you for sending them in. Let's do a news quiz now. And the way we do these are I ask the question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. If you win, some guy wasn't using this anymore, so I
appeal you're early.
That. Yeah, that's yes. Right. Well, it's Eastern Orthodox Christmas, so do it a little later. So let me ask the first question. Again, if you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll point at you. So question number one, San Diego politician Tony Adkins was recently selected for a new position. What is it? Does anyone know this?
We do.
Do you have a question? I'm sorry. Tony Adkins is a San Diego politician in the Assembly, I believe, right? Assembly members, Tony Adkins. She has a new role.
Is it mayor?
Nope. Yes. You got it.
Yeah, that's right.
Woo. Renee, could you be my runner?
Runner with E.
Yeah.
Our high-tech way of getting you to this this grand prize. So you're back there.
Pace yourself when you eat it.
Yes, yes.
Pace yourself.
Next question. A little foreign policy here. The Cossacks, warriors who were known for their service to the Tsarist state in Russia, they've been given a new high-profile role in Russia. What are they doing? You're right in front of me, and you were first. What?
Guarding the Olympics in Sochi.
That is correct.
Oh, God.
Yes. The next question. Police have released the name of the 19-year-old shooter who killed two employees where last week? Yes. It was a mall in Columbia, Maryland. I'm going to throw it. Let's see if this works. And if I hit you in the head. Okay. Let's see. Tens of thousands of people marched down Market Street on Saturday protesting what? Your hand was first? That's right. It was the 10th annual Walk for Life. Renee? I'm on video, so if I get it wrong, I'll get it really wrong. We'll go viral with that. Okay, Central Californian salmon are threatened with extinction in just one of the effects of what weather condition the state is facing. And I saw your hand first. That's right.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Who told Californians last week, quote, I used to say, take the ins and throw them out, take the outs and throw them in. I don't say that anymore, unquote. Sir, back in the back. That's right. Renee? Let's see what's in here. That was part of his State of the State speechifying. In an attempt to quell months of anti-government protests, Ukraine's president offered an opposition leader what government position? Sorry, ma'am? That's right.
No.
Yes. Renee, and for the record, the opposition rejected the proposal. Renee, come on.
Thank you.
Okay, a few more. Attorney General Eric Holder suggested that the U.S. government might be able to hold discussions with what fugitive? Sir. Eric Snowden, that's right. Is it Eric? Edward Snowden. Yes. Renee, could you? Thank you. What is the name of the plan by a prominent venture capitalist to break up California? Have you heard about this? Close, but no cigar. Or no little chocolate bag, actually. Yes. No. Sir. Someone raise their hand and say something else. Ma'am. Raise your hand. Yes. The sixth state. The plan is to divide the state into six smaller states, one of which would be Silicon Valley. Okay, one more. Then we'll go out and have some social time. Let's end on this note. Many commemorations are being planned this year in Europe for what centennial? Sir, I saw your hand first. That's right. It is the 100th anniversary since the beginning of that very devastating war. Thank you to our panel, Deborah J. Saunders, Dr. Larry Gersten, and Carla Marinucci. Thanks to all of you here, listening to us online and watching us on TV. I don't know why I gave you my notes. Please join us outside, and don't forget, we'll be back here on February 21st. Have a good week.